All right, welcome to Computer Science E259 XML with J2EE. My name is David Malin. I'm the instructor for this semester. And tonight's lecture is all about an introduction. Two parts. One, get the basics of XML out of the way. What is XML all about? And two, what is E259 all about? What is this course about? What are you in for? But let's begin with a bit of hype. And let me begin by dispelling that hype to lay out the bold claim that XML, at the end of the day, is nothing more than open bracket, something, close bracket. And it really is as simple as that. And it's a curious thing because over the past few years, particularly over the, around the dot-com era, there was a huge amount of hype over this new so-called technology that is XML. But those of you who are familiar with HTML or XHTML already know that those two are markup languages, and XML is not dissimilar from those. In fact, XHTML is a derivative of XML, and it's just all about markup. Open bracket, close bracket, open tag, close tag, and so forth. And yet you see such things as this throughout the media these days. So here is a website, bingodestinations.com, that I like to make fun of since it doesn't change all too often. It's got some nice obnoxious banner ads, but the means by which Bingo Destinations brings to people the very latest in bingo news and game playing is, if we scroll down here, a little bit of information here. So Bingo Destinations information collection. Bingo Destinations uses the latest in XML, extended markup language, to gather the freshest information from its sponsor site. I mean, sort of suggesting that this is a very powerful new technique, and to go to any other bingo site, right, you're really going somewhere inferior. But again, at the end of the day, XML, you know, open bracket, close bracket. Now, I don't mean to close the door on this thing known as XML. That's great. Maybe we choose a new site next year. So I don't mean to close the door on all things XML, given that this is only lecture one, and we do have a few that we'd like to get through this semester, but I'd like to fess up at the outset that what's interesting about XML, and I think what's interesting about this course, are the uses of these open brackets and these closed brackets, are the familiarity that a course like this presents to students with new technologies, with new languages, with new tools that have emerging that at their core, so far as this course is concerned, all draw upon XML in some way. But that's what I think the value of a course like this is, in this familiarity and this introduction that it provides you with to really options when it comes to software development. When you pick up some next project that you need to implement, be it what it may, you know, what additional resources might you have at your disposal 4 months hence? What additional tools might you have in your proverbial toolkit 4 months hence? And that's where we begin tonight, is to take a look not only at some of this hype, but also at some of the value that is actually can stand to be derived from XML and not just something like Bingo Destinations. So this hype, let's just put a few more words to it. So here's one quote that I culled from an article a little while back. XML as a context-rich, data-neutral file format is probably the most important new technology development in the last 2 years, from InfoWorld. That's sort of a bold claim. Elsewhere, we see it's an idea almost as good as peanut butter and chocolate, from the XML EDI groups. Number three, a spreading ooze of data will expand as people exchange data more easily with XML. So a bit of a strange way of putting it, but it is actually rather on the mark. And we actually asked our own student, seems to be a recurring theme tonight. So Tim Bray, XML is like sex. Even when it's bad, it's still pretty good. And this course is going to need some edits next year, I think. So in the classroom, so we asked our students last year to follow up on these sorts of quotes and just give us their own impression at the end of the semester. So they too were presented with such bold quotes as those at the start of the term, and we debriefed them at the end of the semester, and they came back with a couple of quotes like these. XML is beautiful, but as with beautiful people, it is neither easy to get along with nor quick. So that's sort of a mixed blessing of sorts, and that's one of the issues we'll explore in this course, is a lot of the performance issues. After all, open bracket, close bracket, and so forth in fairly large files doesn't necessarily transmit particularly efficiently. It certainly is not the most efficient way to store data when you have a whole bunch of ASCII characters surrounding what's your actual important content. And so we'll consider issues like that, particularly when it comes to a language known as XSLT, which we'll touch upon in a couple of weeks' time. One other quote we got from our own students, XML's strength is its wide adoption and excellent tools. XML itself is not that exciting. And that quote, I think, is pretty much right on the mark. And again, I don't mean to start us off on a down note as to what can't be done with XML. It can't solve all of the world's problems, but the value of it certainly does come in its omnipresence these days, and the tools that have been developed, the stable tools that have been developed, and the increasingly efficient tools that have been developed surrounding XML. So what are the motivations for this particular course? So given the hype that may remain around this language, there is nonetheless value to be derived from XML. So where have we seen it? Well, it is the so-called technology behind the B2B revolution. And this is sort of a buzzword that people have tried to shy away from, I think, more increasingly these days. But when it comes to transferring data between companies, whether this is in the form of purchase orders or other inventory data, or really any kind of data at all with which you want to associate some form of metadata, XML is sort of the obvious choice these days, rather than anything many more proprietary than that. Web services. This is an increasingly popular idea. It's an increasingly compelling technology, if you will. In short, and we'll talk about this later in the semester, web services is sort of the newfangled approach to remote procedure calls, but remote procedure calls that are much easier to interface with than they might have been in years past, and they provide you with really the illusion that a function or a method call on your local machine is happening locally, whereas really that call, whether it's retrieval of the latest sports information or weather report or something more computationally interesting, is actually happening elsewhere in the world on some arbitrary web or other type of server. .NET. So it's kind of tough, I think, at least for me, to define even what .NET is in a sentence. Even if you go to Microsoft's own website on .NET, they got a whole lot of pretty pictures, a lot of prose, and yet really no succinct definition of what .NET is. But what I can say about .NET is that underlying it is similarly XML, particularly as it relates to distributed services that might be implemented with the .NET framework. How calls are marshaled up and delivered across the wire all at the end of the day boils down to XML. XML makes developing websites easier and more flexible than even before. So this is a claim that was touted quite early on as one of the primary motivations for a language like XML, particularly when coupled with a language called XSLT, which is Extensible Style Sheet Language Transformations. These two languages, as we'll see later in the course, allow you to separate your content from your presentation, similar in spirit to how Cascading Style Sheets, CSS, are really designed to allow you to somewhat, more so than in the past, separate out your stylization, your aesthetics, from the actual content of your web page. I think performance issues surrounding XSLT have hindered to some extent the use of XML with a language like XSLT for the dynamic generation of web pages. But the vision has been, and I think is becoming increasingly feasible, of storing a lot of your data, or at least delivering your data in an XML format, and then, quote-unquote, rendering it with what's known as an XSLT style sheet that can be tailored not only to the type of browser that a user viewing your content might be using, can be tailored to particular types of devices so that you could use the same XML file for instance, the day's movie listings or the movies that you have in your online rental database. But if a user is visiting you via a standalone PC, you render that information with one style sheet, complete with graphics and pretty pictures and colors and so forth. Whereas if they're visiting that same resource via a PDA or a WAP-based phone, you might want to deliver the same content, but in a very, very much minimized form, and so you might apply a different style sheet. And that, too, is one of the capabilities allowed for by XML and its derivatives. So what are the goals of this course? Well, to put aside, henceforth, a lot of the hype, a lot of the buzzwords that have surrounded XML, and really look at what is valuable about it, what good tools exist, what resources already exist off the shelf that one can incorporate into their own tools and development. And our three focuses in this course are going to be on, one, practicality. Just what do you need to know to actually get some job done with XML or with some technology derived thereof. Two, applications. So what tools are necessary? What other technologies are necessary to actually get that job done? And three, possibilities. After this course, where might you go with these new tools in your so-called toolkit during the semester? How might you deploy them in the most intelligent fashion possible? And we're going to do this in an upward direction, starting in the first few lectures from the basic building blocks of XML, XSLT, XML parsing, and so forth, and then building our way up to the higher level languages that have evolved and to some of the more, dare say, user-friendly tools that have evolved from those basic building blocks. So what will you get come term's end out of this particular course? Well, certainly an understanding of XML itself and the syntax and the basic, the data structures, the algorithms that underlie it and its use. But you also get, as we playfully dubbed here, experience with a whole bunch of languages and tools alike. Among them, DTD, SVG, XForms, XInclude, XLink, XML Base, XML Encryption, XML Key Management, XML Namespaces, XML Schema, XML Signature, XPath, XPointer, XQuery, XSLFO, and XSLT, all in just a few months' time. Now, certainly we'll focus in greater detail on some of these languages, but certainly by term's end, you'll have a familiarity, if not an in-depth understanding, of each of those that I just enumerated, all of which have their places in software development, all of which have their uses. Beyond those particular languages, SACS and DOM, which are two particular APIs, the interfaces to the use of XML that we'll begin looking at in lectures 2 and 3, JAXP and TRAX, these two are standard APIs that are now integrated into the Sun JDK, software development kit for Java, a standard approach that you can use different people's implementations of some of these tools, but all through a standard API that you can trust is not going to change from month to month. JSP and Java servlets, we will look at and draw upon various tools and technologies from J2EE, and I'll come back in a bit to the prerequisites and the expectations of the course with respect to familiarity with these, but we'll provide you too with the experience and with the knowledge of what you need to know to get a servlet container started, what you need to know to configure JSPs to launch a servlet, and to generally make use of those two technologies. HTTP, SOAP, web services, WSDL, UDDI, each of these will recur throughout the course, particularly toward the course's end. We'll spend more time looking at web services unto themselves. And then finally, tools like FOP and Stylus Studio, Tomcat, Xalin, Xerces, and XML Spy, almost all of which are freely available tools. Xerces and Xalin and Tomcat in particular all come out of the Apache project, are freely available, and are perhaps the de facto industry standards these days. So you'll have quite the familiarity with those. Two Windows-centric tools, Stylus Studio and XML Spy, the latter in particular, are really the de facto standards in WYSIWYG editors when it comes to developing XSLT style sheets and XML schemas and a variety of other types of documents that we'll discuss in this course. And as an aside, we've arranged for students at least this semester to have full-fledged licenses to that software throughout the semester to make use of. But beyond the semester, most every one of the tools that we will introduce and make use of is freely available. And that, too, in and of itself, is a compelling aspect, I think, of a lot of these technologies that have developed around XML. So our agenda for tonight. Well, we began with bingo destinations. We talked briefly just now about computer science E259, but what we'll launch into next is just the first of the content in the course. What is J2EE? How does Java relate to the course? What is XML? The syntax. Let's get the open brackets and the closed brackets out of the way. And then at tonight's end, we'll come back and discuss the course in particular, the expectations of it, the type of work involved, where we're going, and how it will likely go. But that was a huge mouthful on my part. And given what's ahead of you, does anyone nonetheless have any questions? Yeah. The projects and so forth? Yep, we'll chat a bit more about that later, but yes, the course is actually platform independent, so you can use Windows, Linux, Unix, Solaris, Mac OS.
I guess what I was wondering is, I'm doing some stuff with an embedded processor, which has like UC Linux on it. Are you going
to do that? Not in particular. We won't go into embedded architectures or the like. The funny thing is, even in these embedded environments, for instance, in sensor networks, which makes use of these tiny little embedded devices known as moats, folks have actually gone and implemented with of questionable value or design choice, but XML parsers for even such devices as those. And it's a curious thing to be using a limited memory device and using something rather verbose like XML. So we won't focus on that in this course, but there's certainly a community of folks who are looking at those kinds of things. Other questions? Well, if you're unfamiliar with some of the Extension School's offerings, you may be wondering why there's a camera and a little red light blinking in the back of the room. So this course is part of Harvard's distance education program, which means that not only those of you here tonight are enrolled in or might be enrolled in the course, but there's also a good dozen or more other students who you'll probably never meet during the semester because they live either outside of Cambridge or outside of the United States. But what this means for you, the local students, is that these lectures will also be available to you online, usually within 24 hours or so of their recording. And students each semester make use of those in the event they're not able to make some class, if they'd like to review some material. But just know that generally all of this kind of information will be available to you and to them as well. Absolutely. Every single handout that we'll print out at the front of the classroom will also be, and is already posted on the course's website for tonight's offerings. And we'll come back to the course's website in just a little while. But other questions that you might have? No? All right. So let's begin here, because one of the questions students often have at the start of this course is exactly what familiarity they need to have with J2EE, Java 2 Enterprise Edition. The short answer is none. If you looked at the course catalog, what is cited as a prerequisite is a comfort, quote-unquote, with Java and a comfort with HTML and XHTML. So what does that mean in real terms? Well, if you have, in extension school terms, taken something like E50A, E50B, or more advanced courses, you certainly have the comfort of with Java that we would expect for a course like this. If you've simply been programming in Java for the past year or more, you probably have the comfort with Java that we would expect in a course like this. If you have ever made a web page, however hideous, you probably have the comfort with HTML that we would expect in a course like this. In short, the course does not begin so much with the building blocks that we teach Java syntax or HTML syntax. We assume as much, but then we build from there. So far as J2EE is concerned, several of you, if not many of you, have probably never used any of the enterprise aspects of Java, but that's okay. And this course is entitled XML with J2EE. The course's focus is ultimately on XML itself and its derivatives, but the context, the domain in which we experiment with and explore these various languages and technologies is in a Java enterprise environment. So even though the course's first couple of projects will be very much client-side focused, that's really just so that we can begin to ramp up, again, in this bottom-up approach to the course's development. But by course's end, projects 3 and 4, for instance, will involve using your own servlet container, developing your own website, portals, authentication modules, and so forth. But that's just a teaser. More on that a little later tonight. So J2EE is really just an additional suite of classes, or libraries, if you will, that don't necessarily come with the standard distribution of Java that you're probably familiar with, certainly if you've taken a introductory Java course. However, you will not need to download for this course the J2EE SDK, for instance, from Sun's website. Rather, what we will do is pluck from J2EE the various components that we need, because we simply don't need the overhead of the entire API. So as the course proceeds, we'll provide you in great detail with exactly what modules or classes you might need to make use of, but you certainly won't be on your own. And I think you'll find, if you've skimmed through it already, the project specifications sometimes clock in at 10 or 20 pages, not because I hope they take that long, but because we provide you really with a lot of hand-holding when it comes to configuration, so that not only can you work, for instance, in this course on the Linux cluster, the FAS cluster that Harvard offers to students, but also on your own personal machine. So take comfort in the fact that a lot of the detail in these specifications are footnotes and parenthetical remarks about how to set up the project's context on your Mac or on your PC. You can certainly develop on your own local machine. J2SE is something that you should be familiar with, even if you've never heard the acronym before. If you've been programming in Java, you've been using J2SE. As to the version of Java that we'll use in this course, even though Java 1.5 has been out for a little bit of time now, we will be sticking with 1.4.2, which is quite stable, and it plays particularly well with a lot of the XML-related tools that are out there. Moreover, in Mac OS, only for 10.4 is Java 1.5 currently available, and so as not to impose an undue burden on students, we're simply going to stick with the most stable of the packages. That is not to say that you can't use version 5 or 1.5 of Java, but just be aware that everything we've developed in the course and tested with the course is on this particular distribution. And you'll notice, for instance, that in some of the off-the-shelf XML libraries that we'll begin to make use of in the semester, not all of them jive very well with 1.5, if only because one of the packages, for instance, uses ENUM as a package name. Well, as of Java 1.5, you can't use enum as a keyword anymore. So little nuisances like that will recur through the course. So with that said, this is what we would expect use of, but you're certainly welcome to experiment with whatever version happens to be on your machine. So a typical J2EE architecture. So this is the spirit with which we'll draw upon J2EE, certainly as we reach projects 3 and 4 in the course. So we claim that the above is a sort of typical architecture. And that's also part of what J2EE is. Not only a set of classes and libraries that you can code against, but also it's sort of a developmental framework, an architecture with which you can architect enterprise type system. So here we have what might be a typical architecture where on the top you would have the so-called client tier, which would consist of any number of PCs, computers, computing devices, laptop computer, or PDA. But then the first question we begin to ask ourselves in an architecture like this is that if your enterprise application has on its back end some kind of database, be it whatever form of database, some sort of business logic where your actual code, your number crunching, your computations are happening, and then given a presentation layer, which might be your Apache web server, or might be your Jakarta Tomcat servlet container, or any such presentation technology, how do you piece all of these various components together? How do you deliver that content from the presentation layer to the client? Do you deliver it by way of XML, leaving it to the client to render it with an XSLT style sheet? Perhaps one possible approach. In the presentation and business logic layers, when you're actually ready to marshal up the data or the numbers that you have crunched or the output that you have generated from this layer of your software, well, how do you funnel that over to your presentation layer? Just a text file and say, spit this back out to the user? Do you simply pass the data along and let the presentation layer render that sort of information? Even in the back-end database, the kinds of queries that you're going to be executing. Well, there's increasing support these days for XML output from industry standard database systems, such that you can get back not only a row, for instance, from a SQL database, but you can get back an XML structure, a hierarchical structure that has retained all of the metadata from the database that you might then pass along to, say, your presentation layer, to actually render that information in a more specific fashion. So what you see atop this picture here is really a whole bunch of question marks. And one of the things we'll do as the semester proceeds is answer that question, or ask that you answer that question for yourself. Where does it make sense to deploy XML? It's one thing to say your bingo destination's website uses the latest in XML, but is that a good design decision? We'll present you with a lot of options in this course of the semester, but we'll leave it to you in part to judge for yourself, is what you just did, say for a project, the wisest decision? Could you have done better knowing perhaps more, for instance, what comes later in the course when looking back on earlier projects and so forth? So XML. I have ridiculed it quite sharply already this evening as open bracket, close bracket, but upon entering this door, I mean, what was XML in your mind? What's this stuff all about? Yeah?
It's just a generic markup language. It's a way to present
data. Yeah, it's a generic markup language. It's a way to present data. It's a way to associate so-called metadata with your data. Well, what's metadata? Well, Chris, our videographer, and I were talking about metaphysics before. Well, it's probably quite simpler than that. Metadata is just sort of fundamentally inconsequential information that's wrapped around the actual important data. And we'll come back to an example in just a moment that elaborates on that. But it's, if you're more savvy with something like HTML, well, it's sort of like an arbitrary HTML. You can invent, you can use any tags you want, any attributes you want, anywhere you want. It's entirely up to you. And as an aside, I read off that Bingo Destinations blurb a moment ago and said that XML stands for Extended Markup Language. Well, the folks over at Minor Point, to be sure, but folks over at Bingo Destinations didn't even get the acronym right. It's Extensible Markup Language, so not quite the very latest. So what is XML in more formal terms? Well, if you look through the actual specification for it, you'll walk away with sort of more formalized definitions as these. So it's a language for creating other languages. That's what it means to be a meta language. Meta language is one with which you can craft other languages. Well, XML lets you define schemas for tab-based languages. So that's really a more formalized way of saying it's a markup language. It allows you to define what your data should look like, how it should be marked up. And it allows you to extend any existing language. And this, simple as the notion is actually a powerful feature offered by something like XML, because it really lends itself fundamentally to this notion of backwards compatibility. As we'll see during the semester, it's very easy to incorporate new features into any application that underneath the hood makes use of XML throughout its design, because you can extend the definition of your schemas to allow for new elements, for new attributes that weren't there before, but usually without so much as breaking your existing code. The new content will simply be ignored, for instance, by older implementations. What do we mean by an XML schema? Well, HTML and XHTML are, in a sense, schemas. They are a set of rules that say what tags you can or must use when actually marking up some content. You must, for instance, have an HTML tag at the start. You must then have a head tag, followed by a title tag, followed by the corresponding close tags, then a body tag, and so forth. Well, other schemas that use this notion of open brackets and close brackets might be those used for financial transactions. Those of you who use things like Microsoft Money or Quicken these days might very well be downloading your data in some sort of encrypted XML format. Why? Well, it's so incredibly easy then for the application to tease apart the various fields, especially when the amount of data you're downloading with each download varies. You might have 0 transactions, you might have 20. XML allows you to tease those apart if appropriately marked up on the server end. Business documents. Not uncommon is the use of XML markup for things like purchase orders or invoices. Any sorts of documents that have predefined fields that you'd like to capture with some kind of tagging schema. Remote procedure calls. Even more increasingly common, to the point where even when I more recently was trying to whip up something for research purposes related to the tracing of internet worms, and I wanted to be able to, for instance, have multiple clients who were at the time monitoring themselves for incoming worm attacks, wanted them to be able to share information about their incoming data. Well, dare say the most obvious choice these days, given just the sheer availability of tools in various different languages, is to make a function call, essentially, over the network to that other client, passing to him some number of arbitrary parameters, all of which have been marked up with XML. The advantage being, especially in an environment like this, to offer a more specific example, this client software in question was all written in C. This was Win32 kernel type software, but I didn't really want to write the server or the other end application that listens for this data and essentially combines all of this worm related data in C or C++. I could whip it up much more quickly in something like Perl or Java. Well, the beauty of using something like XML or SOAP or XML-RPC, which are remote procedure call formats for using XML, is that it doesn't matter what language you use to implement the other end, because there are tools these days that allow you to abstract away the actual language used to generate the data and reconstruct function calls implementations in other languages altogether. So you get a sort of platform independence with anything based on something like XML. And then the more obvious and yet strikingly useful aspect of XML is such simple things as configuration files, particularly in the Unix and Linux world. There are so many different formats for configuration files. Pine has its own configuration file. Procmail has its own types of configurations. Any of the Unix binaries have their own sort of customized, proprietary, if you will, or unique file formats for configurations, which means every time you want to write an application that makes use of some sort of customized preferences, well, you're also writing, in effect, a parser for your own configuration file. Now, I wouldn't recommend taking a course, 14 lectures of XML, just so that you can output more useful configuration files. But just the fact that you can take an off-the-shelf XML parser, compile it into your application, and then just make one method call and say, parse this file and give me back an object representing all of the parameters I've stored in that file for my application's configuration, is just wonderfully useful. All of this, all of these tools and technologies surrounding XML have really lent themselves to utility and reusability, and that alone is a powerful thing. So who is behind XML? Well, the W3C. The W3C is who? So it is the World Wide Web Consortium. These are a bunch of volunteers who have, well, that is true. Trick question. So the W3C is essentially a bunch of volunteers, some of them down the road at MIT, as well as in other locations in the world. Tim Berners-Lee is a member of it. He, in fact, works down the road quite often at MIT. bunch of folks who write a lot of the web-related standards these days. Certainly all of those related to XML. This is not a concept that we'll come back to throughout the course, the process by which this organization works, but the various version numbers or version equivalents that it applies to the various XML-related standards is worth keeping in mind, because the curious thing about this course in particular is that it's tough to craft the syllabus on day one that's not going to change, because inevitably halfway through the semester some new version of the XML spec or the XSLT spec or the XML schema or XQuery spec comes out that's markedly different from previous versions. What we try to do in this course, and we'll see when we take a look at the syllabus, is stick with the most stable, the most finalized versions of each of the languages we'll look at, but with an eye toward the future and the next version. And we'll come back to that in just a bit. But here is essentially the process. If someone wants to work on an XML-related standard within the W3C, it is first stamped as a working draft. Once a group of people have agreed that, you know, this is in pretty good shape, it's time to chat about this with a larger group of people, it takes on the last call working draft status, after which it migrates upward to a candidate recommendation, where it would then be vetted by additional or other types of people. Once it passes the approval, if you will, of those groups of people, goes up to proposed recommendation status, and finally to a recommendation, which somewhat paradoxically is not so much as a recommendation as it is an actual specification. So once a W3C document reaches recommendation status, it's a recommendation only in the sense that this body of individuals recommends to the world that folks use this definition of XML or XSLT. At any point in this process, though, as you might imagine, you can dip down into other versions, which is why it's hard even to predict exactly when the next version of something will be deployed. And by version, versions are an important issue with a lot of these languages, because you'll find, especially as we begin to dabble with XPath and XSLT, they don't always do what you'd like them to do. There are glaring omissions in functionality that folks have redressed with various extension functions that we'll glance at as well. But it's a useful thing to keep one's eye on the next phase of W3C developments, because it usually makes your life easier by adding, if you will, more functions, more methods, more capabilities to these various languages. Unfortunately, because you can slide down in the process from candidate recommendation all the way back down to the beginning, it's even tough to commit and say, well, it's in candidate recommendation status. We might as well teach this version of the language in this course, because the rug has gotten pulled out from under us before, and things end up getting quite overhauled even as they reach that status. And you'll even find books on bookstore shelves these days based on drafts of these W3C documents. So any book, for instance, that you see currently about XSLT 2 is a bet. It's an educated bet that that book will be relevant in a few months' time when the spec hopefully is finalized. But as of now, XSLT 1.0 is the only one you can trust will be the same tomorrow. So it's a quickly moving world, or certainly a quickly moving publication cycle. So, XML in 10 sentences or less. So these were actually the goals with which the W3C set out to define this language known as XML. It's sort of telling why we ended up with the language or the meta language that we did when you see such goals as number 10. Sort of a implicit way of saying XML documents tend to be rather large, and it's certainly a very verbose way of marking up your data. Terseness in XML markup is of minimal importance. And I think it's quite clear, as you'll see this semester, that that goal was quite well satisfied by the end of the development cycle. XML shall be, number one, straightforwardly usable over the internet. I think you'll find, too, that that's actually a useful goal in mind, and it actually, too, was satisfied. Number two is absolutely true. Three is true, and for those of you familiar, SGML is a remarkably arcane syntax, a similar markup language. XML is SGML compliant, but it's actually human readable and understandable and can be defined in just a few minutes' times. SGML is a little bit more complicated. Four, easy to write programs. That is absolutely true. The number of optional features in XML is to be kept to the absolute minimum, ideally zero. That's of questionable satisfaction these days. Six, they shall be human legible and reasonably clear. This, too, is one of those funny things where It is remarkably useful that you can actually see your data in human-readable form as you're, for instance, sending it across the wire in the form of a remote procedure call, or where you're making a query to one of your database systems using a marked-up XML fragment. Just being able to view the data makes debugging, makes development so much more user-friendly to the developer. And that is actually not a feature, I think, to be downplayed in terms of its utility. Seven, the XML design should be prepared quickly. That might have been true for XML, has not certainly been true for some of those drafts that followed. The design of XML should be conformal and concise. That's absolutely true, as you'll see in Project 1. XML documents shall be easy to create. You can do it with Notepad. And number 10 was absolutely satisfied as well. So quick teaser of the history here, only because, not because this is interesting, but just because it puts some of the development cycle into perspective. XML itself has been around since 1998. So not too many years at all, but that's when the definition that has persisted today was first finalized. XML 1.1, which essentially fixed some bugs, if you will, in the original XML spec, was just ratified a couple of years ago. And it's XML 1.1 then that we'll focus on in this course. So now the fun part, an actual example that we can talk about. And despite the simplicity of this type of example, it really does allow us to capture in lecture one alone what XML is, what the syntax is, what the rules are, so that we can really get to the juicy, the interesting stuff in lecture two. So here is an XML fragment. It has a number of tags reminiscent of HTML, if you've never seen XML before, and it seems to have some content. Anything that's not itself flanked with an open bracket, closed bracket is some kind of content. So this fragment of XML is clearly what sort of entity? Yeah, some kind of book order, maybe from an Amazon.com system or the like, something that shows you in the form of various fields exactly who bought this particular Harry Potter book and on what date. Well, some of the jargon that we'll use throughout the semester, and it really is as straightforward as this, something like order at the very top of this document. You might see in an HTML document the HTML element as the root of your document. Every XML document must have a root, and it may have only one root element. An element is something that in aesthetic form begins with open bracket, some name, close bracket, and the name given between those brackets is the element's name. The element itself consists of not only the node, if you will, that is that order element, but also everything below it is associated with that element as children or as descendants. So there's clearly some kind of hierarchy to XML, as there is to HTML, particularly when you pretty print it and indent it as follows. So a child element of order would be sold to. And softball question here, what would another child element of order be? Sold on, as well as item. So this particular order element has three children. Pretty simple. So a start tag. So a start tag is just the actual incarnation that demarks the beginning of the conceptual entity that is an element. So here we have an example. Open bracket item is a start tag, followed by a corresponding end tag. And I won't dwell on such necessities as balance when it comes to XML markup, since you're presumably familiar with such from HTML development, opening and closing tags symmetrically. Well, just to put the jargon out there, an attribute. Any open tag can have zero or more attributes associated with it. So an attribute is something that in effect modifies or is related to that particular element in question. It must be followed by an equal sign, followed by a quoted string of zero or more characters, numbers, words, whatever. You can have almost any amount of white space in an XML document. So you could have 10 spaces before the equal sign. You could have 10 carriage returns after the equal sign. But so long as you have attribute name followed by an equal sign, followed by a quoted string at some point, you are satisfying the XML specification. You may not have attributes doubly named in a start tag, which means if you have an attribute called foo, you'd better only have one attribute in that element called foo. There's no notion of order, as we'll see in lectures 2 and 3, even though you might, as a human, write out, say, all of the attributes in alphabetical order. Curious thing about an XML parser is that it's not required, nor does it usually maintain that order. If you're particularly anal when it comes to looking over your output and having everything alphabetized or structured in some common fashion, sort of have to give up some of that control when it comes to XML tools that we'll see. And David, D-A-V-I-D, is a text string, and it will be called, as we'll see in lecture 3, the value of a text node. So each of these entities we've discussed, attributes and elements and text, all fall under the moniker of nodes in a tree. And we'll come back to that in our discussion of DOM. So what about this idea of extensibility? Sure. Absolutely. So you cannot have a start tag can only have one attribute of a certain name. So you can have foo equals x and foo equals y in the same start tag. You could have those same attribute names elsewhere in the document. And as you say, you can also have the same element name recur throughout the document pretty much in any location. And that's with one caveat, as we'll get to later in the semester, if you're actually not writing this XML freehand, but instead are trying to adhere to a schema that you or someone else has written, then it might be the case that a certain tag, a certain element can only appear at one place in the document. For instance, it is not allowed or correct to put the HTML tag anywhere you want in an HTML document. It can only go one place. It must be the root element of the document. And to be clear, notice that how many root elements are there in this document? Well, still in this extended example, one. It would be incorrect and disallowed to, for instance, put a second element here and try to call it an XML document. Every XML document must have one and only one root. So the little box here kind of gives it away, but what is distinct about this example vis-a-vis the previous example? There's still some shared content, but what's sort of remarkable about the differential between these two? I'm sorry? So address now has a number of elements itself, and in fact was address even in the previous example. So it wasn't even there. So in fact, all of these bold-faced blue tags are new to the document. And as this little spoiler says, you can extend an XML document's content without breaking the existing structure. And that's the key aspect. In very few languages, Java and C and C++ and so forth, can you begin to insert arbitrary data types in certain structures that you might be maintaining in your code without subsequently going back and fixing all of the functions that try to manipulate that data. Or if you have an array, you can't just insert some new datum in the middle of that array without then modifying the appropriate getter or setter methods appropriately. Whereas XML, the parsing of this file will, after project one, never be left to you. You will be able to pass that buck off to an industry standard parser that does things relatively efficiently and entirely automatically for you, such that when you pass this new document to that parser, you'll get back not only the same kind of structure as before, but it will have a bit more information in it, specifically nodes for this data as well. And that too is a useful thing. It's very quick to modify applications that make use of such things as XML markup. So, yeah.
If there's text mm-hmm. that has like a closing tag, but it actually should be, if your name was David and Carrot, for example, you know, like a bracket.
Oh.
How do they deal with, like, do they just start counting all the brackets and then trying to figure out, like, what's content was an actual tag.
So it's a good question, and let me change the example to make it even more clear. So if we have a tag foo, and then inside of that we have an equation, is 3 less than 5? Is this the sort of idea you're getting at?
Yeah, yeah.
So this would be invalid XML, because there are certain special cases whereby you may not have an open bracket anywhere in the document except as the start of a tag, a start tag, or an end tag. There are exceptions to that. You can actually escape characters like this with what are called C data sections, and we'll come back to that, where it's the equivalent of saying, it's the equivalent of a backslash behind all a whole blob of text or putting it within a comment. But what is the solution to this in HTML too, actually?
Ampersand LT.
Yeah. That is how you would mark it up. And this, it is ugly, and it will be a funny thing when quite literally, in just a couple of weeks' time, we'll be writing on occasion what are called XPath expressions, which allow you to perform mathematics and execute a variety of functions inside of an XSLT document where you will actually write such code as this. You might say select all attributes called bar whose IDs are less than 6. So that would literally be an XPath expression, and even though you conceptually mean select all bar elements whose ID child has a value of, that is less than 3, you'll actually write it as this in the XML document. So for better or for worse, it's good to bear in mind. But there's very few special cases like that in XML, as we'll see. But a good question. Other questions? So content versus presentation. This is an issue that we'll focus in great fun and with great detail in Project 2, where we'll tackle a project called My Blockbuster, which, among other things, will provide you with a medium-sized XML document that has a whole bunch of data that Blockbuster or Netflix or the equivalent might maintain on its movies. Who's in the movie? Who directed the movie? How many stars did it get? What's an image of the movie jacket, and so forth. And then you'll be asked to render that content in some way, largely of your design. But the takeaway will be that given the same kind of content, as I said before, it can be rendered entirely differently based on users' preferences, based on the device that's visiting the website. And what XSLT in particular allows you to do is with one brushstroke completely overhaul the aesthetics of your website simply by applying a different style sheet. And the power is much greater than something like CSS, because CSS allows you to modify the appearance of certain elements, but not actually the generation of HTML elements as XSLT does. Why XML? Well, application integration. So a common picture these days when you have, when a company has older legacy systems that they want to interface with one another, whether it's a billing system or an HR system, an accounting system of some sort, you usually bring in a team of consultants or your own personnel to actually code up hooks or interfaces that link these systems together, coupling the usually proprietary interfaces. Well, and so introducing a new application in the extreme sense means writing hooks to each of these systems and actually tying them together in some standard form. Well, XML doesn't solve this problem for the first time in history. There have long been means by which you can have machines talk a common language and actually interface with one another. But what's curious about XML is, again, its sheer popularity, the momentum behind it, the readability of it, the availability of tools surrounding it, and the fact that it is, by definition, not a proprietary mechanism for actually tying systems together. So the alternative these days, and again, not dissimilar in spirit to what's always been possible, but the only difference now being that the language commonly spoken would be XML itself, is don't write hooks for each of the n squared possible connections you might have among n systems, but rather update each of them, or, you know, choose systems that speak as an output mechanism XML, so that tying a new application in simply requires that it speak this common language. Similarly, interfacing your systems with other systems at remote sites, with remote partners, same idea. It's not necessarily the best language. It's not necessarily the new way to do things, but the fact that the world, for better or for worse, has latched onto it as a standard, and the fact that there exists so many tools for it simply makes it much more compelling of a choice these days. Well, in the past, again, you've already had solutions to these kinds of problems, DCOM and COM, CORBA, Java RMI, all of these ways of actually linking systems together or creating the illusion of local procedure calls that are actually being executed remotely, but for a variety of reasons, haven't been as easy to use, haven't been open, certainly, some of these standards. So again, XML doesn't necessarily solve new problems, but it does it in its own, often non-proprietary way. Web services provide a new way to expose functionality. So RPCs have existed for as long as two computers have been connected together, for the most part. Well, XML, RPC, and SOAP, as we'll see, are perhaps the two primary languages underlying web services today, whereby web services just means, and web is somewhat misleading, since you're not visiting things with a browser, you're just making a TCP/IP socket connection, but it is yet another way of accessing data or performing computations on a remote system by having all of the connections between points A and B transparent to you. And in fact, one of the coolest demos that we'll get to in this semester when we talk in particular about web services involves, for instance, something as simple as this. We will show in this particular example a simple application just so that the code is nicely displayed on one screenful. But what I'll do is implement a very basic calculator, essentially a Java class that implements a calculator so that I can pass in two ints, A and B, and get back as the return value the summation, A plus B. What I'll show you, though, with particular tools, such as Axis, which is a free toolkit from Apache as well. Axis is a SOAP toolkit, which essentially means that if you write a class like this calculator I just described, and you pass it to this tool known as Axis, Axis can generate from it what's called a WSDL file, Web Services Description Language, which is just an XML-based markup that describes exactly what your class is doing, what kinds of parameters its methods take. Well, an int and an int. What kinds of functionality it implements. Well, it performs summation of some sort. What we'll then do with that WSDL file is take it to another machine, run it through a program called WSDL to Java, that will take this platform-neutral description of a service and the parameters that are inputs to that service, and it will regenerate code that implements that same functionality, but that can be deployed on another machine altogether. You can even take this one step further and implement something, for instance, in Java, generate the sort of platform-neutral description of it, but then on the other side, dynamically output a C-based implementation or a Perl-based implementation of the code that doesn't implement the same logic of that calculator, but provides the illusion for that other machine that the mathematics will be performed locally, when really what that tool is doing is generating what are called skeletons and or stub functions that allow the remote computer to execute the add function or the add method. But what's really going on behind the scenes is that generated on that machine is a whole bunch of TCP/IP socket layer calls that are executed when that computer calls add. Everything is marshaled over the internet to wherever your server happens to be running, where you actually have the logic of add implemented. The response goes back across the wire, and when that method add returns on computer B, you are handed A plus B, and you don't even know where it was executed. But the fact that you can dynamically generate this is a very powerful thing indeed, and the fact that you can generate it for many different popular languages today means you're really freeing yourself up to choose the best language for the job in question on disparate machines without tying yourself into one particular technology or language. So it's a pretty cool thing, and granted, you don't need to take a whole course on how to implement A plus B, but you'll see that it's representative of some of the really cool stuff that you can do with this thing, with these technologies, and also you'll see in some of the descriptions of past students' final projects what other students have done with things like web services. Well, why, of course? Well, such sites as Bingo Destinations are possible as well. Why don't we do this? Let's take a 5-minute break so we can change tapes. If you'd like, there's a vending machine in the basement, bathrooms down there. When we come back in 5 minutes, we'll do a quick run-through of what the expectations and content of the course are, and then after that, we'll call it a night, and I'll be around to answer questions. So we'll come back in 5 minutes. All right, so now the hype is not about XML, but it's about the course and what you're in for in this semester. So the prereqs are very straightforward. You are not expected to have taken certain courses before. You are not expected to have anything other than what I've dubbed a comfort with Java or HTML or XHTML. If you have experience with either or both of those but are somewhat uncomfortable, I'd suggest come on up right after class and chat with me about where you're at and where your discomforts might be. Expectations, quite straightforward. Attend or watch all lectures, complete 4 assigned projects, and design and implement a final project. More on the latter in just a moment. Grades are determined by an equal weighting of the first 4 projects, and then the final project is worth about 25% more of the other projects, but that's it so far as grades go. And you'll have about 3 weeks, if not 4 weeks, for each of the projects. But more on that in just a moment. the lectures first, because they rather capture the content of the course and where we're going. Well, tonight, again, is just meant to be an introduction, give you a sense of what you would be in for this semester, what you would walk away with, what you would not be getting in a course like this. Next week, we really dive into the juicy stuff, the fun stuff, where you can actually, subsequent to class, pick up an XML parser and start doing something interesting with it. Or actually, you'll pick up your own XML parser and start implementing parts of it. But we'll focus not only on XML in slightly more detail as it relates to the specification itself, so that we can look at an XML parser and build it ourselves from the ground up. We'll also look at the first of two programmatic interfaces to XML, namely SAX, which is the simple API for XML, which is an event-driven API, which essentially allows you to say to a parser, call a method for me every time you encounter some information that I deem relevant to me. And we'll make that more clear next week. But in lecture 3, we'll focus on the second of these two programmatic APIs, DOM, which isn't an event-based parsing approach to XML, but rather a tree-based approach, where you hand an XML document to a DOM parser, and it hands back to you a pointer, or a reference in JavaSpeak, to the root of an XML tree that it is allocated in memory, that capture in with objects in memory each of the various nodes that we've talked about, elements and text nodes and attribute nodes and a few other node types that we'll spell out in the weeks to come. Lecture 4 will move away from XML itself and how to get at it and focus more on now what you can do with it once you have gotten it from an XML parser, focusing specifically on XPath and XSLT, the first of which is a query language, fairly simple but powerful query language that lets you execute fairly intuitive queries, though this might look a little cryptic for tonight's purposes, so that you can get any kind of data out of you that you want from a document, but thinking about the query in a very hierarchical form, saying give me foo/bar/baz to get back all of the baz elements, for instance, from a document. XSLT, meanwhile, is again this transformative language, which allows you to take an XML document and literally transform it into something else, whether that's ASCII text or another XML document or XHTML or WML, whatever the case may be. We will look specifically at versions 1 and 1 of these two languages because the 2.0 versions, which will be more powerful, are still not yet in finalized status. So this is something that we'll play by ear throughout the semester, glancing at some of the potential shortcomings of the current incarnations of these languages, giving you a teaser of what will hopefully be redressed in the future versions, but without necessarily committing and raising your expectations to the point where you can trust that certain features will actually remain come term's end. So we'll use our judgment as the semester goes there. Lecture 6, namespaces in XML, SVG, and XSLFO. So the first one is namespace in the C++ sense, for instance. Well, XML offers a similar notion of keeping variable names and element names distinct. SVG, scalable vector graphics. We'll take a look at an XML-based language with which you can create images, vector-based images, polygon-based images using lines and circles and other structures, all just marked up in XML. XSLFO, formatting objects. We'll look at somewhat briefly at an even more powerful markup language that lets you create fairly finely tuned PDF documents or PostScript documents. The XSLFO is in a sense the sort of PostScript language of XML. And I think you'll find that just as humans, in my opinion, shouldn't be reading PostScript, they dare say shouldn't be reading XSLFO, but we'll give you enough of a taste of it, enough of the basics, so that even in one or two of the projects, we'll empower you to create PDF files, inventory receipts, for instance, or other types of documents using the basics of XSLFO without getting so muddied in the details that it becomes an onerous task. So you can take an Adobe Illustrator file and output, for instance, SVG, I believe, and in the other direction as well, but don't quote me on that. And as it relates to XSLFO, that I'm not sure offhand. Lecture 7. In Lecture 7, we'll mark the migration for us from client-side development, really because it offers us greater simplicity and an easier domain in which to start experimenting and exploring, So the server side approach to the course, which is where we'll persist throughout the remainder of the course, taking a look at HTTP 1.1 and cookies and sessions as it relates to the use of that protocol, JSP 2.0 and Java Servlet 2.4, providing you with enough of the background on each of these technologies so that you can begin to now dabble in various J2EE specific applications. But again, we assume no familiarity with J2EE itself, but this lecture will mark the first point at which we draw from J2EE and add to your so-called Java toolkit some of these enterprise-oriented capabilities. Lecture 8, we will actually violate our own mantra by spending some time on XQuery 1.0, which despite the version number is not yet itself in recommendation status. So we'll be a little non-committal when it comes to introducing some of the features of XQuery, but we've included it in the syllabus because it's so incredibly capable, or should be. It's so much more powerful, you'll see, than XPath. And it is, if you will, the SQL language of XML. It will allow you to execute much more interesting queries and actually perform some form of computation during those queries, which is something XPath simply doesn't allow. So you'll see what's lacking in XPath, you'll see what's likely to come in formal versions of XQuery, and you'll find in the market, too, that there are implementations of these specifications, like XSLT2 and even XQuery 1.0, but again, subject to change. So we'll tread lightly. Question? You can absolutely use a lot of these candidate recommendations as folks have implemented them. What you'll find is that, and what we'll do in this course, is try to align ourselves a bit more closely with those so-called de facto standards that I mentioned earlier. So a lot of the software that comes out of the Apache project, for instance, Xalin and Xerxes, being the XSLT processor and the XML parser respectively, have only committed to supporting at the moment XPath 1 and XSLT 1.0. And what you have in those products, those free products, are very stable, very efficient implementations of those specifications. So we'll try to follow what the tools that most people are using because you can trust in their stability. We'll look then in Lecture 8 as well at DTD. So if you've ever looked at the doc type element at the top of an XHTML or an HTML document, you've gotten a sense of what a DTD document kind of sort of looks like because they're cited in those elements. DTD, we'll see, is the first means by which you can require a certain structure to your document. So the reason that HTML has predefined rules for where elements must go and what elements must be present in a document and what attributes are allowable for certain HTML elements is because HTML was defined with a DTD, a document type definition. XHTML is also defined with a DTD. Your own XML documents that you create in this course for any purpose can be associated with a DTD if you write that DTD. But as with a lot of these languages, you'll find weaknesses in DTD. Though it is quick and dirty and useful and correct, you'll find that there are certain things, certain constraints you just can't express. And so we'll move then in Lecture 9 to XML schema, spending notably more time on XML schema, which is itself a standard and which has been excerpted from in a variety of other XML derivatives because it provides, among other things, a typing system for XML. So even though at the end of the day you're transmitting open bracket, close bracket across the wire with things that look like numbers, things that look like floating point numbers, they are ultimately just ASCII strings. XML schema allows you to impose structure on what are otherwise just ASCII strings so that when you receive that XML document on the other end of a wire, what you're actually getting back, for instance, from your XML parser or your application is not a string that looks like negative 2.5, but a float that contains negative 2.5, for instance. We'll look in Lecture 11 at web services and SOAP and WSDL in more detail, doing a number of fun demonstrations. Lecture 12, we'll try to knock off all of the other X-related XML technologies, which are useful to have some familiarity with because several of them are rather omnipresent in other specifications, but of themselves are not that compelling. XML base, for instance, is about as complicated as the notion of an HTML base tag, which tells you what is the base directory relative to which all other links should be resolved. Well, there's an entire W3 specification defining that for XML. We will spend incredibly brief time on that. Lecture 3 will likely have a guest lecturer join us on XML in industry for some definition of XML in industry. And then in lecture 14, we shall conclude. Questions on content lectures? Yeah. Web 2.0?
Well, maybe it has a number of
this, AKA semantic web? We won't focus on that. To some extent, Web 2.0, semantic web, you're right, I think, to call it more of a buzz term than, say, a new technology. In fact, it's funny you should ask, because I was just reading on Wikipedia, I think, what the world defines as Web 2.0 these days, last night, entirely coincidentally. And as I understand the buzzword, to be honest, it's been rather defined, Web 2.0, as by way of analogies rather than by any technical definition. So whereas Web 1.0 involves sites like CNN.com pushing news at you, well, Web 2.0 involves syndicated RSS feeds from other sites that you sort of pull from and so forth. So the short of it is that we won't focus so much on those only because there's not some juicy technical content underlying a lot of that. We will touch on some of the related aspects of Web 2.0, among which is RSS, which is just a wrapper for XML. It's a schema of XML that allows you to syndicate content, and we'll actually use something quite similar to that in Project 3 when we retrieve dynamically news feeds in RSS. So I would say if I wanted to write a more marketing-friendly description for the course, absolutely Project 3 and even Project 4, you know, draw upon some of these ideas in Web 2.0, but I would not be so bold as to slap the label on it. Web 2.0, more in my estimation, it's a vision, it's a way of describing this evolution of the internet to blogs and more websites where it's not static content being pushed at users, but it's rather a populace contributing to the information, where you have blogs allowing for comments and people to push photographs up to a website and so forth. And it's not something, and someone else can challenge this certainly, but I don't think you'll find yourself outdated because we're teaching Web 1.5 in this course. I think that's more of a buzzword slapped on a natural progression of things and not so much technology related, but application related. But certainly those can disagree that wish. So the projects. So I think, admittedly, that this course is a lot of fun, and hopefully that's coming across in my elevator pitch here tonight, but granted the material tonight is fairly dry in that it's just push information at you, but the projects themselves are really what this course is about. There are four of them, the first of which you already have in your hands, my first XML parser, which is twofold in design. One, you will actually implement parts of an XML parser yourself. What we'll spend some time on next week is looking at a sort of a little simplified XML parser that I whipped up that gets the job done. You can feed it certain XML documents. It's not a full-featured XML parser, but it will allow you to fire off what are called SACS events or build a DOM tree using your very own XML parser. But what I didn't get around to doing is implementing support for attributes. So just to give you a taste of the innards and the underlying workings of an XML parser, what we'll do is provide you with a framework of an XML parser that mostly works, but that is not doesn't have a full feature set, and you'll get your hands dirty with actually implementing support for attributes as it relates not only to the parsing of the document, but to the construction of the DOM, the tree itself. What you'll do in the latter half of that project is put aside your work of art and never again use your own XML parser, because it's probably not going to be as good as what else is out there. And we'll introduce you in the latter half of Project 1 to the latest version of Apache Xerxes XML parser, which is, again, the sort of de facto standard in XML parsers that exist that you can pull off the shelf today. In Project 2, we will dabble in a slew of things, particularly XSLT. The first aspect of Project 2, dubbed Xtube, will be that My Blockbuster notion that I mentioned earlier. We will provide you with an XML database and a whole bunch of GIFs and JPEGs of movie covers and ask that you render dynamically a presentation of this data in a certain format so that from the XML you get a nice user-friendly web page that shows you the title of a movie, the number of stars that it received, the actors in it, the director, formatting things nicely so that you separate with commas all of the various actors' names, maybe putting the word and at the end of the string. All these nitty-gritty things that in and of themselves, you know, not that useful or interesting, but are a wonderful venue for actually getting your hands dirty with the language of XPath and the language of XSLT in a very safe, you know, client-side environment. The fun part, the particularly fun part of the project, though, will be the XTube aspect of Project 2, in which you will be handed an even bigger XML file on the order of several hundred kilobytes that contains geographic and naming information and connection information for all of the tubes, trams, and trains in the London commuter rail system. So you will be given geographic location of all the tube stops, train stops, tram stops. You will be given the names of all of the stops. You will be given data on what stations connect to other stations, where you can catch connections. You'll be given the colors of the lines that run on those stations, linked to the websites for each of those stations. There's a lot of data we've thrown in there, because the challenge to you will then be to render that for the user in a human-readable, user-friendly format so that I can visit your web page and find out, all right, I am at location X in London, and I want to get to location Y. Show me the route that I want to take. Show me the connections that I want to take. But you're not just going to show it to us in HTML format or XHTML format. You're also going to dabble in Project 2 in SVG. Again, this graphical language for XML that will actually allow you to draw a geographic map of all of London's train systems, for instance. And just to give you a teaser of this, I'll defer that just a little bit so that we leave you with a bit of anticipation as to drawing these maps. But you'll actually get a geographically accurate representation of the London Underground system, complete with hyperlinks that you'll implement that will take you to more information on that particular site. It's a fun thing, and I liken it to this game I used to play as a kid called Vet, which was this Mac game, which was one of those driving games. But the cool thing about this driving game, in which you were meant to drive throughout the streets of San Francisco from point A to point B while racing some AI simulation of it, is that they gave you a map of the city. So it wasn't just this sort of, you know, a heavy-handed approach to driving through the city and just generally trying to get your way there. Will also provide you in similar spirit with a map of London's underground. And I can't emphasize enough the utility of actually knowing what your graph should look like when you're trying to generate it dynamically. So more on that in the weeks to come. Project 3, Wahoo. So clearly a play on Yahoo, and it too will be a portal of sorts. So it's in Project 3 that we move from client-side to server-side. You will be provided with your own configuration for your own Tomcat server, servlet container, so that you will be running and essentially managing your own servlet container or application server on either the FAS system or also on your local system. So it's in this project that you'll be given all of the requisite configuration files, but you'll have enough experience starting the server, stopping the server, maybe tweaking things to your liking, so that come term's end, you should also exit the course with some comfort with actually setting up your own, for instance, application server for servlets, JSPs, and the like. Wahoo itself will be a web portal that will have authentication and allow for creation of users so that you can visit this site. And then after logging in, according to a module that we'll provide you the framework of, you'll be able to get news feeds, and you'll be able to subscribe to different categories of news, and you'll be able to check the latest weather or the latest sports by way of extensions to this portal that you yourself will implement. And it will be our first implementation of a representative J2EE architecture. Somewhat simplified, to be sure, but yet another stepping stone from the more basic Projects 1 and Projects 2. And in Project 4, we will conclude these assigned projects with Scamazon, another cheesy play on words, in which you'll implement your own e-commerce engine, complete with shopping carts and the ability to browse virtual aisles, the ability to add various items to one's shopping cart, and then to check out. The checkout process will not be handled by Scamazon, but rather by a so-called warehouse that you will implement as itself a web service. So you'll actually go from start to finish implementing not only the e-commerce engine itself, but also the virtual fulfillment partner, this warehouse that will be communicated your purchase orders by way of SOAP or XML RPC, essentially remote procedure calls using this framework of web services. And it's in the final project that the reins come off, and you get to do anything and everything that you might want to do, either independently or working with one or two partners in the course. The final project's only charge is to craft, design, and implement a project of your own that somehow makes use of one or more XML-related technologies. It doesn't need to be grounded in J2EE. It can be in another domain entirely. And it is certainly something that in the past we have allowed students to craft projects that are not only interesting to them, but perhaps relevant to work or relevant to other projects that they might want to implement on a more personal basis. It's simply subject to a discussion with us as to what they want to achieve. And in fact, perhaps in no other course have you been assigned your final project on day one, but you do already have in your hands the specification for the final project. There's a few salient dates, none of which, rest assured, are all that close in the future, but this is what one would keep an eye on. And I think it is, for many students, the most gratifying aspect of the course, because you're not handed a how-to, a specification as to what to implement, but really a blank slate that allows you to dabble with any one of any number of the aspects of the course that you found most attractive or relevant to you. There are no, perhaps your favorite slide yet, there are no exams, and there is no midterm for the course, and the homework comes in the form of these projects, which you will find is, in addition to questions that might begin the project, just to really get the blood flowing, you know, how do you answer this question, or what XPath expression might you execute to retrieve this data? The focus of the projects really is on implementation. And again, you'll have at least 3 weeks for each of the projects, and to be clear, they really are meant to be done over 3 weeks. They don't take 3 weeks to do, but we always get sort of feedback, if you will, at the end of the semester about how much time the projects took. Well, that is almost always from the students who did them on the Saturday and Sunday before the deadline. They are not meant to be done in such compressed amount of time. What we typically suggest is that, at least for projects 2 through 3, you do a third of them a week. Doesn't necessarily take a huge amount of time for some students, but you at least then don't find yourself frantically racing at the last minute and stressing over certain implementation details, bugs, which are inevitable, but rather you get to enjoy, I think, the experience, because we often allow for a lot of design discretion, and a lot of students have a lot of fun with it, especially with things like the portal and the e-commerce engine, where it's also about the fun of getting an interactive website to actually work. So, with that said, there's no expectation for project one that you begin immediately. This is meant to be really a 2-week project once we begin with the real content of the course next week and in lecture 3, but you do have it now in your hands, and you're certainly welcome to begin dabbling with it. Books for the course. No books are required. In fact, no books are on the shelf at the COOP because they are way too expensive when they're on the shelves at the COOP. Rather, on the course's website and its syllabus are links to not even Amazon's site, but the Amazon third-party website, which you can find these books for even less. The reason being they are useful, and they are often quite useful references for students during and after the course, but there is so much free information out there, much of the best of which I think we've linked on the course website, that we don't even expect that you do procure one of these books. If you'd like, though, or if you're the type of person who does enjoy the comfort of or the utility of a book and paper, the two middle books there focus on not only XML, but kind of touch upon a little bit of most everything from the course, but not in significant detail. These are sort of overarching references on, you know, quick and dirty reference on XSL or XPath or DTD or XML schema. The one that is in most detail on one particular subject is this last book, XSLT Programmer's Reference by Michael Kay. XSLT is a language we'll use throughout the course for a variety of purposes because it has so many uses. That is perhaps the best reference out there. And don't be scared by its phone book size thickness. It's actually a wonderful reference because Michael Kay has essentially taken the sort of shorter W3C recommendation for XSLT, but put it into much more human-readable form. You will find on the course's website links to most every one of the W3C recommendations for the languages that we'll look at in this course. Rare will be the case in which you need to go read those things. They are useful because they are correct, and they are the definitions of these various languages, but they're not designed, shall we say, with human comprehension in mind. They're really meant to be implementation specifications, but not user manuals. But you will see, for instance, in project one that we have spent, or that I have spent the time looking through the recommendation, for instance, for XML and trying to simplify the grammar that defines the XML syntax so that we can dabble with our own simplified form of it. And what I will suggest, though, is that though I wouldn't try to teach yourself any of the semester's topics from the recommendations themselves, when you have a relatively arcane question or corner case that you're not quite sure how the language would behave or what the rule is as it relates to some question, then the recommendations are wonderfully useful because the answer is going to be in there and is the definitive answer often. But if you like XSLT, the latter is a useful reference, and the first book is for those of you who really want to learn a bit more about J2EE, even beyond what we'll do in this course. That first book, which comes in two parts, only the first of which is really germane to our purposes in this semester, is a useful book as well. But it is available, I believe, in that same edition, if not the prior edition, online for free. So that, too, is linked on the course's website. So in short, choose one or more of these books if you'd like, but what we promote for each week's lectures and the projects is self-assigned readings from those books or really from the relevant categories on the resources page of the website. You'll find that W3 Schools is one of the websites we commonly link to, wonderfully readable and human-friendly tutorials on a lot of the subjects. They won't make you experts in the material, but they will certainly get you started in understanding the material. So nice.fas.harvard.edu. You will each be entitled to an account on this machine. Ultimately, all of the projects you submit must compile and or execute on this machine, but they've all been configured in such a way that it should be relatively painless migrating from development on your own machine, if you would like to do that, to FTPing it to the server and then just running it there. After all, we're using XML, we're using Java, which in theory are platform independent, and granted there will always be a few hiccups, and this is why we propose that students do not FTP said files up to their account at 12:29 p.m. before a project is due. There will always be issues, but for the sake of uniformity, we do all submissions on here and also evaluate all of the work on the NICE system. But you shouldn't find too many hiccups from that process. To obtain an account, simply follow the directions that are in Project 1. You can do that entirely online. Almost always, one or more students has trouble with their ID number. Contact me immediately if you have questions as to why the system doesn't seem to be recognizing your ID number if you are, in fact, registered for the course. So, the course's website is, I hope you'll find, fairly self-explanatory. However, useful to point out are, one, as was asked before, handouts. So anything handed out in lectures is going to be on the lectures page in PDF format. So we already have the material there. Subsequent to tonight's class, probably sometime tomorrow night, there will also be a link on this page to the real video that's being shot tonight. It will be available in a few different formats, like high resolution, low resolution, and audio only. What's nice about the distance ed program is that any PowerPoint slides we might use during class are also synchronized pretty well with the material, so you don't even need the paper in front of you. And Chris often will shoot the slides themselves, which actually comes out pretty well, even in real video format. You'll need real video software, which is freely available. I will say more personally, do not download Reels Media's version of Real Media if you don't want a half a dozen background processes and other spam-related things running on your machine. A nice Windows equivalent is called Real Alternative, and it is linked on the software section of the website. Real works, but it's horrible software, I think, in my own personal estimation. So Windows users at least have an alternative, real alternative. Grades, you'll be able to access your grades online via this link. The listserv, this is a wonderfully useful list every semester, which is designed for you all to chatter on about, we say, superficial details of the projects, not to ask, hi, everyone, I'm having trouble figuring out the XPath expression for this, but rather for questions like, I'm getting this error when I spawn the Tomcat server on my machine, or where do I configure my environment variables to do this, or this sample style sheet from lecture is not compiling correctly, how do I run those sorts of questions. But generally, to pose questions that you might think that others might like answers to, can go to the listserv, but as we explain in the syllabus, we do expect that you exercise discretion in the types of questions and answers you provide on the listserv. After tonight, I know a number of you have already subscribed, but as Project One requires, do go ahead and subscribe yourself to this listserv via the directions there or in the Project One itself. Projects will all be listed and accessible via the course's website. So tonight you received a PDF of the specification. You received also a printout of the printable code. The reason that I hand this out is that what we will usually do after, or at some time during the week, we'll work this out over email, is have sections of sorts whereby I'll offer not so much lecture-oriented discussion, but rather project-focused discussion. We'll likely record that as well for the distance students in audio format. And then you'll see in this printout there are such things as line numbers and so forth. It's printed in quite readable form. So I'll really try to get you started with the projects so that you're not simply faced with 40 pages of paper and sort of the sense of an insurmountable task. I'll often walk you through the code and get you started on where you need to focus your eyes and how you would get started. And you'll also find code distributed only via the website. You can either grab it via SSH per the Project One, or if you're developing locally, it might be easier to grab it here and you can browse the index of code. So every project except the final project will have code distributed with it. The final project won't have a distribution since it will be your own code you're writing, but what I did post recently were the proposals that past semesters of students have submitted, since an inevitable question, especially when we give out the spec at lecture one, is I have no idea what to do. That's a really hard question for me to answer, and every year I sort of just give back similarly dumb looks, like, I don't know what you should do, do something that's fun for you. And that's going to be my answer again this year, but now at least I can punt and say, well, maybe this will prod your thinking a little bit, since you have a good 30 or so ideas from others. This is not to say that this is the menu from which you should choose your final project, but it will hopefully get the juices flowing and give you a sense of where you might take your project or maybe where you could do things different from what these students proposed. So do take a look, if you'd like, at some of those past proposals there. Finally, perhaps the most useful two links on the website, handouts and so forth aside, are one, the resources page, where I've tried to be quite diligent about maintaining current links to the latest, not only recommendations, but resources. So for instance, if we were to get to the subject next week of, say, XPath, well, you'll find that what I've linked here is not only the XPath version 1 recommendation, but three different XPath tutorials. And again, what we promote is self-assigned readings from any of the topics you know are to be on the syllabus. So if you see on the syllabus, tonight's about XPath and XSLT, I would suggest either before lecture, or if it works better for you after lecture, to skim through or to spend some time on such tutorials as those, if not any of the books that you choose to get. Finally, software. Almost every program that we will use in this course is freely available. Certainly the required software is freely available, and you'll find hopefully current links on this page as well to a variety of tools that we'll use. And this, I think, too, is a nice takeaway from this course, is that if you're not familiar already with something as simple as a build tool like Ant, which is sort of the XML equivalent and the Java equivalent of Make or GMake, well, it's a useful tool, a useful skill to exit the course knowing that, wow, I can automate the building, the compilation of my software in the future because I, you know, acquired some familiarity with build.xml files for Ant. And you'll, again, obtain experience with SVG and the various viewers that can be used for Tomcat and so forth. So there's a lot of these little fringe benefits, I think, for those that enter the course unfamiliar with such software. Some questions on those kinds of logistics or availabilities? Yeah?
Do you have access to a wireless network while we're here?
You do. You should. This building should be wirelessly networked. If you try to, these days I think it's as good as you're prompted via a web page to enter probably your Harvard ID number. So let me defer to you since I've been registered on the network for 8 years now, so I don't know how one does it for the first time, but I'm almost positive, yes.
I did this a year or two ago. It was all wireless in the science building. Mm-hmm.
I hope so. I think so is the answer. I will look into this so that I know we've had students do it before and I've never asked how they did it. So.
The thing I know now is you can register your computer at least if you're reading it.
You can, if you're a degree candidate. Okay. I'll get a definitive answer on this so we can figure something out. Well, it's MAC address based, so it's a little more involved to spoof. John? Of the assigned projects or the final projects?
Final projects that other people did, just so we could
see what... Sure. Sure, I can probably do that. Let me go through our archives over the next week or so and at some point. Sure. And then I'll say they should be bigger and better than those. Yeah. Sure. I'll spend some time and see if I can dig up some of the more exciting ones that we've seen. Of course, I'm going to pick out the best ones, which is going to set the bar naturally higher. Course-related emails ideally could go to this address, but since I'm the only one reading it that's really for archival purposes, you're certainly welcome to email me directly. The listserv address we've already mentioned as well. A word on academic honesty. I will just say do familiarize yourself with this, particularly as it relates to dual submission, as it relates to completing work that you intend to use outside of work, particularly for the final project, but we're quite clear in the specifications and so forth what kind of conversations or, for instance, restrictions are expected. So do familiarize yourself with that. Brownie points. So on the course's website, under resources and software, you'll see an invitation to do your best to nag me if anything on the website gets out of date, which happens since sometimes folks are reading Slashdot in the morning or whatever websites before I am, and so it's news to me that XSLT went to version 2.0 this morning. So by all means, if you see such things or come across such things, drop me a note, and we'll pass it along to the class, email the listserv, and we'll try to keep things as up-to-date as possible, certainly with software versions as well, as newer versions tend to redress past bugs in the software. With that said, looking ahead then, what you have in your hands is Project 1, which certainly start on the first few questions, which are as easy as get an FAS account, subscribe to the listserv, maybe tackle the other stuff, but you're not expected until after Lecture 2 to really dive into that. We will coordinate over email or by next week a sort of section time, which will be live at some point, but also recorded and available online. Will be a sort of walkthrough for the projects, a couple of weeks for each project. And beyond that, I'll stick around for a while if you have any questions about the course, what you might be getting into, or what your background might be. So, hope to see you next week at Lecture 2.